Marco, "and the master will be waiting. Come." Ezio moved like a shade among the crowds and the stalls, striving to keep the men within earshot as they crossed the square and made off down the street which led in the general direction of St. Mark's Square. "Will the master agree to our new strategy?" asked Silvio.
"He'd be a fool not to."
"You're right. We have no choice," Silvio agreed, then looked at Grimaldi. "Which kind of makes you redundant," he added unpleasantly.
"That is a matter for the master to decide," retorted Grimaldi, "just as he will decide whom to place in Mocenigo's shoes, you or your cousin Marco here, and the best person to advise him on that is me."
"I wasn't aware that there was a decision to be made," said Marco. "Surely the choice is obvious to all."
"I agree," said Silvio edgily. "The choice should fall on the person who organized the entire operation, the one who came up with the idea of how to save the city." Marco was quick to reply.
"I would be the last to undervalue tactical intelligence, my good Silvio. But in the end it is wisdom which one needs in order to rule. Do not think otherwise."
"Gentlemen, please," said Grimaldi. "The master may be able to advise the Committee of 41 when they meet to elect the new doge, but he cannot sway them. And for all we know, the master may be thinking of someone quite other than either of you."
"You mean yourself?" said Silvio incredulously, while Marco merely gave vent to a sneering laugh.
"And why not? I'm the one who's put in all the real graft."
"Signore, please, keep moving," put in Dante. "It'll be safer for you all when we get back inside."
"Of course,"
agreed Marco, quickening his pace. The others followed suit.
"He's a good man, your Dante," said Silvio. "How much did you pay for him?"
"Less than he is worth," replied Marco. "He's loyal, and he's trustworthy. He's saved my life on two occasions. But I wouldn't say he was exactly loquacious."
"Who needs conversation from a bodyguard?"
"We're here," said Grimaldi, as they arrived at a discreet door in the side of a building off the Campo Santa Maria Zobenigo. Ezio, keeping a safe distance between them and himself, aware as he was of Dante's extreme vigilance, rounded the corner of the square just in time to see them enter. Looking round to ensure that the coast was clear, he climbed the side of the building and positioned himself on the balcony above the door. The windows to the room beyond were open, and within it, seated in a heavy oak chair behind a refectory table covered with papers, and dressed in purple velvet, sat the Spaniard. Ezio dissolved into the shadows and waited, ready to listen to all that transpired. Rodrigo Borgia was in a filthy mood. Already the assassin had frustrated him in several major enterprises and escaped every attempt to kill him. Now he was in Venice, and had eliminated one of the cardinal's principal allies there. And as if that wasn't enough, Rodrigo had had to spend the first 15 minutes of this meeting listening to the parcel of fools left in his service bickering about which of them should be the next doge. The fact that he had already made his choice and greased the palms of all the key members of the Council of 41 seemed to have passed these idiots by. And his choice had fallen on the oldest, vainest, and most pliable of the three.
"Shut up, the lot of you," he finally spat out. "What I need from you is discipline and unwavering dedication to the cause, not this pusillanimous quest for self-advancement. This is my decision, and it will be carried out. Marco Barbarigo will be the next doge, and he will be elected next week, following the death of Giovanni Mocenigo, which, given that the man is 76 years old, will hardly raise an eyebrow, but which nevertheless must look natural. Do you think you are capable of arranging that, Grimaldi?" Grimaldi cast a glance at the Barbarigo cousins. Marco was preening, and Silvio was trying to look dignified in his disappointment. What fools they were, he thought. Doge or no doge, they were still the puppets of the master, and the master was now conferring the real responsibility on him. Grimaldi allowed himself to dream of better things as he replied, "Of course, master." "When are you closest to him?"
Grimaldi reflected. I have the run of the Palazzo Ducale. Mocenigo may not like me much, but I do have his full confidence, and I'm at his beck and call most of the time.
Good. Poison him at the first opportunity.
He has food tasters.
Good God, man, do you think I don't know that? You Venetians are supposed to be good at poisoning.
Get something into his meat after they've tasted it. Or stick something into that Sardinian jam they tell me he's so fond of. But think of something, or it'll be the worse for you.
Leave it to me, Su Altezza.
Rodrigo turned his irritable gaze on Marco. I take it you can lay your hands on a suitable product for our purpose? Marco smiled deprecatingly.
That is rather my cousin's area of expertise.
I should be able to lay my hands on enough cantarella for our purposes, said Silvio.
And what is that?
It's a most effective form of arsenic, and it is very difficult to trace.
Good. See to it.
I must say, Maestro, said Marco, we are lost in admiration that you should associate yourself personally so closely with this enterprise. Is that not dangerous for you?
The assassin will not dare come after me. He is clever, but he will never outwit me. In any case, I feel inclined to involve myself more directly. The Pazzi disappointed us in Florence. I hope sincerely that the Barberighi will not do the same. He glowered at them. Silvio snickered. The Pazzi were a bunch of amateur...
The Pazzi, Rodrigo interrupted him, were a potent and venerable family, and they were brought to their knees by one young assassin. Do not underestimate this troublesome foe, or he will bring the Barberighi down too. He paused to let that sink in. Now go, and get this done. We cannot afford another failure.
What are your own plans, Master?
I return to Rome. Time is of the essence.
Rodrigo rose abruptly and left the room. From his vantage point, hidden on the balcony, Ezio watched him leave alone and cross the square, causing a flock of pigeons to scatter as he strode in the direction of the Molo. The other men soon followed him, separating and taking their own paths out of the square. When all was silent, he leapt down to the flagstones beneath, and hurried off in the direction of Antonio's headquarters. Once there, he was met by Rosa, who greeted him with a lingering kiss.
"Put your dagger back in its sheath," she smiled as their bodies pressed together.
"You're the one who made me draw it.
And you're the one," he added knowingly, "with its sheath."
She took his hand.
"Come on, then."
"No, Rosa. Mi dispiace veramente, but I can't."
"So? You tire of me already?"
"You know it isn't that." "But I have to see Antonio. It's urgent."
Rosa looked at him and saw the intense expression on his face, in his cold blue-grey eyes.
"Okay, for this once I forgive you. He's in his office. I think he misses that model of the Palazzo Seta now that he's got the real thing. Come."
"Ezio," said Antonio as soon as he saw him. "I don't like that look. Is everything all right?"
"I wish it was.
I've just discovered that Carlo Grimaldi and the two Barberighi cousins, Silvio and Marco, are in league with a man I know too well, whom people call the Spaniard. They plan to murder Doge Mocenigo and replace him with one of their own."
"That is terrible news. With their own man as Doge, they'll have the entire Venetian fleet and trade empire in their grasp." He paused.
"And they call me a criminal!"
"So, you'll help me stop them?"
Antonio extended his hand.
"You have my word, little brother, and the support of all my men."
"And women," put in Rosa.
Ezio smiled.
"Grazie, amici."
Antonio looked thoughtful.
"But Ezio, this will take some planning. The Palazzo Ducale is so strongly defended that it makes the Palazzo Seta look like an open park. And we don't have time for me to have a scale model built so we can plan."
Ezio held up his hand and said firmly,
Nothing is impenetrable. The two of them looked at him. Then Antonio laughed, and Rosa smiled naughtily. Nothing is impenetrable. No wonder we like you, Ezio. Late in the day, when there were fewer people about, Antonio and Ezio made their way to the Doge's palace.
"Treachery like this no longer surprises me," Antonio was saying as they went. "Doge Mocenigo is a good man, and I'm surprised he's lasted so long. As for me, when I was a child we were taught that the nobles were just and kind. I believed it, too. And though my father was a cobbler and my mother a scullery maid, I aspired to be much more. I studied hard, I persevered, but I could never make myself one of the ruling class. If you aren't born into it, acceptance is impossible. So, I ask you, Ezio, who are the true nobles of Venice? Men like Grimaldi or Marco and Silvio Barbarigo? No, we are. The thieves and the mercenaries and the whores. We keep this place going, and each one of us has more honour in his little finger than the whole pack of our so-called rulers. We love Venice. The others merely see it as a means of enriching themselves."
Ezio kept his counsel, for he could not see Antonio, good as the man was, ever wearing the Corno Ducale. In due course they arrived at St. Mark's Square, making their way round it to the Pink Palace. It was quite clearly heavily guarded, and although the two of them managed to clamber undetected up scaffolding which had been erected on the side wall of the cathedral which adjoined the palace, when they looked over from their vantage point, they could see that even though they could, and did, leap across onto the palace roof, access to the courtyard, even from there, was barred by a high grille whose spiked top curved outwards and downwards. Below them in the courtyard they could see the Doge himself, Giovanni Mocenigo, a dignified old man who nevertheless seemed like a shrivelled husk inhabiting the gorgeous robes and corno of the leader of the city and the state, in conversation with his appointed murderer, Carlo Grimaldi. Ezio listened intently.
"Don't you understand what I'm offering you, Altezza?" Carlo was saying. "Listen to me, please, for this is your last chance."
"How dare you speak to me like that? How dare you threaten me?" retorted the Doge.
Carlo was immediately apologetic.
"Forgive me, sir. I meant nothing by it. But please believe that your safety is my principal concern."
With that, the pair moved into the building and out of sight.
"We have very little time," said Antonio, reading Ezio's thoughts. "And there's no way through this grill. Even if there were, look at the number of guards around. Diavolo!"
He swiped the air in frustration, causing a cluster of pigeons to take to the air.
"Look at them, the birds! How easy it might be for us if we could only fly!"
Suddenly, Ezio grinned to himself. It was high time he looked up his friend Leonardo da Vinci. Chapter 17.
"Ezio, how long has it been?"
Leonardo greeted him like a long-lost brother. His workshop in Venice had taken on all the look of his workshop in Florence, but dominating it was a full-scale version of the bat-like machine whose purpose, Ezio now knew, was one which he had to take seriously. But first things first for Leonardo.
"Listen, Ezio, you sent me via a very nice man called Ugo another codex page, but you never followed up on it. Have you been that busy?"
"I have rather had my hands full," replied Ezio, remembering the page he had taken from Emilio Barbarigo's effects.
"Well, here it is."
Leonardo rummaged in the apparent chaos of his room, but quickly came up with the neatly rolled codex page, its seal restored.
"There's no new weapon design on this one, but from the look of the symbols and the manuscript writing on it, which I believe to be Aramaic or even Babylonian, it will be a significant page in whatever jigsaw puzzle you are assembling. I think I recognize traces of a map."
He held up his hands.
"But tell me nothing. I am only interested in the inventions these pages you bring me reveal. More than that, I do not care to know. A man like me is only immune from danger according to his usefulness.
but if it were discovered that he knew too much, and Leonardo expressively slit his throat with his finger. "Well, that's that," he continued. "I know you by now, Ezio. Your visits are never simply social. Have a glass of this rather awful Veneto. Give me Chianti any day. And there are some fish cakes somewhere or other, if you're hungry."
"Have you completed your commission?"
"The Conte is a patient man. Salute!"
Leonardo raised his glass. "Leo, does this machine of yours actually work?" asked Ezio.
"You mean, does it fly?"
"Yes." Leonardo rubbed his chin.
"Well, it's still in the early stages. I mean, it's nowhere near ready yet, but I think, in all modesty, that... yes, of course it will work. God knows I've spent enough time on it. It's an idea that just won't let go of me."
"Leo, can I try it?"
Leonardo looked shocked. "Of course you can't. Are you mad? It's far too dangerous. For a start, we'd have to get it to the top of a tower to launch you."
The following day, before dawn, but just as the first streaks of greyish pink were colouring the eastern horizon, Leonardo and his assistants, having dismantled the flying machine in order to transport it, had reconstructed it on the flat high roof of the Ca' Pezzaro, the family mansion of Leonardo's unsuspecting employer. Ezio was with them. Beneath them, the city slept. There were not even any guards on the roofs of the Palazzo Ducale, for this was the hour of the wolf, when vampires and spectres were most powerful. No one but madmen and scientists would venture forth at such a time.
"It's ready," said Leonardo. "And thank God the coast is clear. If anyone saw this thing, they'd never believe their eyes. And if they knew it was my invention, I'd be finished in this town."
"I'll be quick," said Ezio.
"Try not to break it," said Leonardo.
"This is a test flight," said Ezio. "I'll go easy. Just tell me again how this bambina works."
"Have you ever watched a bird in flight?" asked Leonardo. "It's not about being lighter than air. It's about grace and balance. You must simply use your body weight to control your elevation and direction, and the wings will carry you."
Leonardo's face was very serious. He squeezed Ezio's arm.
"Buona fortuna, my friend. You are, I hope, about to make history."
Leonardo's assistants strapped Ezio carefully into position below the machine. The bat-like wings stretched out above him. He was secured face forwards in a tight leather cradle, though his arms and legs were free, and before him was a horizontal crossbar of wood attached to the main wooden frame which held the wings aloft.
"Remember what I told you? Side to side controls the rudder, to and fro controls the angle of the wings," Leonardo explained earnestly.
"Thank you," said Ezio, breathing hard. He knew that if this didn't work, in a moment he'd be taking the last leap of his life.
"Go with God," said Leonardo.
"See you later," said Ezio, with a confidence he didn't really feel. He balanced the contraption over him, settled, and took a run off the edge of the roof. His stomach left him first, and then there was a feeling of wonderful exhilaration. Venice reeled beneath him as he tumbled and rolled, but then the machine started to tremble and fall down the sky. It was only by keeping his head and remembering Leonardo's instructions regarding the use of the joystick that Ezio was able to right the craft and guide it back, just, to the Pezzaro Palace roof. He landed the strange craft at a running pace, using all his strength and agility to keep it stable.
"Christ almighty! It worked!" yelled Leonardo, careless of security for a moment, unravelling Ezio from the machine and hugging him frantically. "You wonderful man! You flew!"
"Yes, by God, so I did," said Ezio, breathless. "But not as far as I need to go." And his eyes sought out the Doge's palace and a courtyard that was his goal. He was also thinking of how little time he had, if the murder of Mocenigo was to be averted. Later, back in Leonardo's workshop, Ezio and the artist-inventor gave the machine a careful overhaul. Leonardo had his blueprints laid out on a large trestle table.
"Let me look over my plans here. Maybe I can find something, some way to extend the duration of the flight. They were interrupted by the hasty arrival of Antonio.
Ezio, I'm so sorry to disturb you, but this is important. My spies tell me that Silvio has obtained the poison they need, and he's handed it over to Grimaldi.
But just then Leonardo shouted in despair.
It's no good! I've been over it, and it just won't work. I don't know how to extend the flight. Oh, bugger it.
He swept papers angrily off the table. Some of them wafted into the large fireplace nearby, and as they burned, rose. Leonardo watched, his expression clearing, and at last a broad smile cleared the anger from his face.
My God, he cried. Eureka! Of course! Genius!
He snatched the papers that weren't already burnt out of the fire, and stamped the flames out. Never give in to your temper, he advised them. It can be terribly counterproductive.
So what's cured yours? Asked Antonio.
Look,
Leonardo said.
Did you not see the ashes rise? Heat lifts things up. How often have I seen eagles high in the air, not flapping their wings at all, and yet staying aloft? The principle is simple. All we have to do is apply it.
He reached for a map of Venice and spread it out on the table. Leaning over it with a pencil, he marked out the distance between the Palazzo Pexaro and the Palazzo Ducale, putting crosses at key points between the two buildings.
Antonio, he cried, can you get your people to build bonfires at each of the places I've marked, and light them in a close sequence?
Antonio studied the map.
I think we could arrange that.
But why? Do you not see? This is Ezio's flight path. The fires will carry my flying machine and him all the way to his target. Heat rises.
What about the guards? Said Ezio. Antonio looked at him.
You'll be flying that thing. For once, leave the guards to us. In any case, he added, some of them at least will be busy elsewhere. My spies tell me there's a curious shipment of coloured powder in little tubes which has just arrived from a country far away to the east called China. God knows what it is, but it must be valuable. They're taking such good care of it.
Fireworks, said Leonardo to himself.
What?
Nothing.
Antonio's men had the fires Leonardo had ordered built and ready by dusk. They had also cleared the areas around them of any watchmen or idle bystanders who might be inclined to warn the authorities of what was afoot. Leonardo's assistants had meanwhile transported the flying machine to the Pexaro roof once more, and Ezio, armed with his spring blade and arm guard, had taken up his position in it. Antonio stood nearby.
"Rather you than me," he said.
"It's the only way to get into the palace.
You said so yourself."
I never dreamed this could actually happen, though. I still find it almost impossible to believe. If God had meant us to fly.
Are you ready to give the signal to your men, Antonio? Asked Leonardo.
Absolutely.
Then do so now, and we'll get Ezio airborne.
Antonio walked to the edge of the roof and looked down. Then he took out a large red handkerchief and waved it. Far below they could see first one, then two, three, four, and five huge bonfires leap into flame.
Excellent, Antonio. My congratulations.
Leonardo turned to Ezio.
Now, remember what I told you. You must fly from fire to fire. The heat of each one, as you pass over it, should keep you in the air all the way to the Ducal Palace.
And be careful, said Antonio. There are archers posted on the roofs, and they'll certainly shoot as soon as they see you. They'll think you're some demon from hell.
I wish there was some way I could use my sword at the same time as flying this thing.
Your feet are free, said Leonardo thoughtfully. If you manage to steer close enough to the archers and avoid their arrows, you might be able to kick them off the rooftops.
I'll bear that in mind.
And now you must go.
Good luck.
Ezio sailed off the roof into the night sky, setting a course for the first fire. He was beginning to lose height as he approached, but then, as he reached it, he felt the machine lift again.
Leonardo's theory worked.
On he flew, and he could see the thieves tending the bonfires look up and cheer. But the thieves were not the only ones aware of him. Ezio could see Barbarigo archers posted on the cathedral roof and on the other buildings near the Doge's palace. He managed to maneuver the flying machine out of the way of most of the arrows, though one or two thudded into its wooden frame, and he also managed to swoop low enough to knock a handful of bowmen off their perches. But as he approached the palace itself, the Doge's own guards opened fire, and they were using fire arrows. One caught in the starboard wing of the machine, and it immediately burst into flames. It was all Ezio could do to keep on course, and he was losing height fast. He saw a pretty young noblewoman looking up and screaming something about the devil having come to claim her, but then he was past. He let go of the controls and fumbled with the harness buckles which held him in. At the last moment he wrenched himself free and leapt forwards and outwards to land in a perfect crouch on an inner courtyard roof past the grill which guarded the palace interior from all but the birds. Looking up, he saw the flying machine crash into the campanile of St. Mark's, and its wreckage fall to the square below, causing panic and pandemonium among the people there. Even the ducal archer's attention was diverted, and Ezio took advantage of that to climb swiftly down and out of sight. As he did so, he saw Doge Mocenigo appear at a second-story window.
"Ma che cazzo," said the Doge. "What was that?"
Carlo Grimaldi appeared at his elbow.
"Probably just some youths with firecrackers. Come, finish your wine."
Hearing that, Ezio made his way via roofs and walls, and taking care to keep out of sight of the archers, to a spot just outside the open window. Looking in, he saw the Doge draining a goblet. He threw himself over the sill and into the room, exclaiming, "Stop, Altezza, don't drink!" The Doge looked at him in astonishment, as Ezio realized he had arrived a moment too late. Grimaldi smiled wanly.
"Not quite your usual accursed good timing, young assassin. Messer Mocenigo will be leaving us shortly. He's drunk enough poison to fell a bull."
Mocenigo rounded on him.
"What? What have you done?"
Grimaldi made a gesture of regret.
"You should have listened to me."
The Doge staggered and would have fallen if Ezio had not rushed forward to support him and guide him to a chair, where he sat down heavily.
"Feel tired," said the Doge. "Going dark."
"I'm so sorry, Altezza," said Ezio helplessly. "About time you tasted failure," snarled Grimaldi at Ezio, before flinging open the door of the room and bellowing, "Guards! Guards! The Doge has been poisoned! I have the killer here!"
Ezio sprang across the room and grabbed Grimaldi by the collar, dragging him back into the room, banging the door shut, and locking it. Seconds later, he heard the guards running up and hammering on it. He turned to Grimaldi.
"Failure, eh? Then I'd better do something to make up for it."
He released his spring blade. Grimaldi smiled.
"You can kill me," he said, "but you can never defeat the Templars."
Ezio plunged the dagger into Grimaldi's heart.
"Peace be with you," he said coldly.
"Good,"
said a feeble voice behind him. Looking round, Ezio saw that the Doge, though deadly pale, was still alive.
"I'll fetch help, a doctor," he said.
"No, it's too late for that. But I shall die happier for seeing my assassin go before me into the dark. Thank you."
Mocenigo was struggling for breath.
"I'd long suspected he was a Templar, but I was too weak, too trusting. But look in his wallet. Take his papers. I don't doubt that you'll find something among them to help your own cause and avenge my death."
Mocenigo was smiling as he spoke. Ezio watched as the smile froze on his lips, his eyes glazed, and his head lolled sideways. Ezio put a hand on the side of the Doge's neck to ascertain that he was dead, that there was no pulse. Ezio drew his fingers over the dead man's face to close his eyelids, muttered a few words of blessing, and hastily took and opened Grimaldi's wallet. There, among a small sheaf of other documents, was another codex page. The guards continued to hammer at the door, and now it was beginning to give. Ezio ran to the window and looked down. The courtyard was alive with guards. He'd have to take his chances on the roof. Climbing out of the window, he started to scale the wall above him as arrows hissed around his head, clattering against the stonework on either side of him. When he reached the roof, he had to contend with more archers, but they were off guard and he was able to use the element of surprise to dispense with them. But he was confronted with another difficulty. The grill, which had kept him out before, now trapped him within. He ran up to it, and realized that it was designed only to keep people out. Its spiked top curved outwards and downwards. If he could climb to the top, he could leap clear. Already he could hear the footfalls of many guards thundering up the stairs to the roof. Summoning all the strength his desperation could give him, he took a running jump and clambered to the top of the grill. The next moment, he was safely on the other side of it, and it was the guards who were trapped by it. They were too heavily armed to be able to scale it, and Ezio knew that in any case, they lacked his agility. Running to the edge of the roof, he looked down, leapt across to the scaffolding erected along the cathedral wall, and shinned down it. Then he sped into St. Mark's Square, and lost himself in the crowd. Chapter 18. The death of the Doge on the same night that the bizarre bird demon appeared in the sky caused a great stir in Venice, which lasted many weeks. Leonardo's flying machine had crashed into St. Mark's Square, already a conflagration, and had burnt to ashes, as no one would dare approach the strange contraption. In the meantime, the new Doge, Marco Barbarigo, was duly elected and took office. He swore a solemn public oath to track down the young assassin who had avoided capture and arrest by the skin of his teeth, and who had murdered that noble servant of the state, Carlo Grimaldi, and probably the old Doge, too. Barbarigo and ducal guards were to be seen at every street corner, and they also patrolled the canals day and night. Ezio, on Antonio's advice, lay low at his headquarters, but he was boiling with a frustration that wasn't helped by the fact that Leonardo had temporarily left town in the entourage of his patron, the Conte de Pexaro. Even Rosa lacked the means to distract him. But soon, one day not far into the new year, Antonio called him to his office, greeting him with a broad smile.
"Ezio, I've two pieces of good news for you. First of all, your friend Leonardo has returned. Secondly, it's Carnevale. Nearly everyone is wearing a mask, and so you..."
But Ezio was already halfway out of the room.
"Hey, where are you off to?"
"To see Leonardo."
"Well, come back soon. There's someone I want you to meet."
"Who is it?"
"Her name's Sister Teodora."
"A nun?"
"You'll see."
Ezio made his way through the streets with his hood up over his head, making his way unobtrusively between the groups of extravagantly dressed and masked men and women who thronged the streets and the canals. He was keenly aware of the clusters of guards on duty as well. Marco Barbarigo was no more concerned about Grimaldi's death than he was about the death of his predecessor, which he had helped to plan. And now that he had made a pious show of seeking out a culprit, he could let the matter drop with a good public conscience and appear to scale down the costly public operation. But Ezio also knew that if the Doge could secretly trap and kill him, he would. As long as he was alive and could be a thorn in the Templar's side, they would count him among their bitterest enemies. He would have to remain constantly on the lookout. He made his way to Leonardo's workshop successfully, however, and entered it unseen.
"It's good to see you again," Leonardo greeted him.
"This time I thought you were dead for sure. I heard no more of you. Then there was all that business over Mocenigo and Grimaldi. Then my patron took it into his head to travel and insisted I went with him, to Milan, as it happens. And I never have the leisure to rebuild my flying machine because the Venetian Navy finally want me to start designing stuff for them. It's all very vexing."
Then he smiled. "But the main thing is, you are alive and well."
"And the most wanted man in Venice."
"Yes. A double murderer,
and of two of the state's most prominent citizens. You know better than to believe that.
You wouldn't be here if I did.
You know you can trust me, Ezio, as you can everybody here. After all, we're the ones who flew you into the Palazzo Ducale.
Leonardo clapped his hands, and an assistant appeared with wine.
Luca, can you find a carnival mask for our friend here? Something tells me it might come in handy.
Grazie, amico mio.
And I have something for you.
Ezio handed over the new codex page.
Excellent, said Leonardo, recognizing it immediately. He cleared some space on the table near him, unrolled the parchment, and started to examine it.
Hmm, he said, frowning in concentration.
This one does have the design for a new weapon, and it's quite complex. It looks as if it'll attach to your wrist once again, but this is no dagger.
He pored over the manuscript some more.
I know what this is. It's a firearm, but on a miniature scale. As small as a hummingbird, in fact.
That doesn't sound possible, said Ezio.
Only one way to find out, and that's to make it, said Leonardo. Luckily, these Venetian assistants of mine are expert engineers. We'll get down to it straight away.
What about your other work?
Oh, that'll keep, said Leonardo airily. They all think I'm a genius, and it does no harm to let them. In fact, it means they tend to leave me in peace.
In a matter of days, the gun was ready for Ezio to test. For its size, its range and power turned out to be quite extraordinary. Like the blades, it was designed to attach to the spring mechanism, which strapped to Ezio's arm, and could be pushed back to conceal it, shooting out in an instant when required for use.
How can it be that I never thought of something like this myself? Leonardo said.
The bigger question, Ezio replied wonderingly, is how the idea could have come to a man who lived hundreds of years ago.
Well, however it came about, it's a magnificent piece of machinery, and I hope it serves you well.
I think this new toy comes at a most timely moment, said Ezio, earnestly.
I see, said Leonardo.
Well, the less I know about it, the better, though I can hazard a guess that it may have something to do with the new doge. I'm not much of a politician, but sometimes even I can smell skullduggery.
Ezio nodded meaningfully. Well, that's something you'd better talk to Antonio about. And you'd better hang on to that mask. As long as it's Carnevale, you should be safe on the streets. But remember, no weapons out there. Just keep it up your sleeve.
I'm going to see Antonio now, Ezio told him. There's someone he wants me to meet, some nun called Sister Teodora over in Dorsoduro.
Ah, Sister Teodora, smiled Leonardo.
Do you know her?
She's a mutual friend of Antonio's and mine.
You'll like her.
Who is she exactly?
You'll find out, grinned Leonardo.
Ezio made his way to the address Antonio had given him. The building certainly didn't look like a convent. Once he'd knocked and been admitted, he was convinced that he'd come to the wrong place, for the room he found himself in reminded him more than anything of Paola's salon in Florence. And the elegant young women who came and went were certainly no nuns. He was about to put his mask back on and go when he heard Antonio's voice, and moments later, the man himself appeared, leading on his arm an elegant and beautiful woman, with full lips and sultry eyes, who was indeed dressed as a nun.
"Ezio, there you are,"
said Antonio. He was slightly drunk.
"Allow me to introduce Sister Teodora. Teodora, meet the, how shall I put this, most talented man in all Venice."
"Sister," said Ezio, bowing. Then he looked at Antonio. "Am I missing something here? I've never really seen you as the religious type." Antonio laughed, but Sister Teodora, when she spoke, was surprisingly serious.
"It all depends on how you view religion, Ezio. It's not men's souls alone that require solace."
"Have a drink, Ezio," said Antonio. "We must talk, but first, relax. You're perfectly safe here. Have you met the girls yet? Anyone take your fancy?
Don't worry, I won't tell Rosa.
And you must tell me. Antonio was interrupted by a scream from one of the rooms that surrounded the salon. The door flew open to reveal a wild-eyed man wielding a knife. Behind him on the blood-soaked bed, a girl writhed in agony.
Stop him, she screamed. He's cut me and he's stolen my money.
With a furious roar, the maniac grabbed another girl before she could react and held her close, his knife at her throat.
Let me out of here, or I'll carve this one up too,
he bawled, pressing the tip of the knife so that a little bead of blood appeared on the girl's neck.
I mean it.
Antonio, instantly sober, stared from Teodora to Ezio. Teodora herself was looking at Ezio. Well, Ezio, she said with a coolness that took him aback, now's the chance to impress me. The maniac was making his way across the salon to the door, where a small knot of girls was standing. As he reached it, he growled at them.
Open it!
But they seemed rooted to the spot with fear.
Open the sodding door or she gets it!
He dug the knife a little further into the girl's throat. Blood began to flood from her neck.
Let her go, commanded Ezio.
The man swung round to face him, an ugly expression on his face.
And who are you? Some kind of benefattore del cazzo? Don't make me finish her off.
Ezio looked from the man to the door. The girl in his arms had fainted, a dead weight. Ezio could see the man hesitate, but any moment now he would have to let her go. He readied himself. It would be hard. The other women were close. He'd have to pick the precise moment and then act fast, and he knew he had very little experience of his new weapon. Open the door, he said firmly to one of the terrified prostitutes in the group. As she turned to do so, the madman let the bleeding girl fall to the ground. As he prepared to rush out into the street, he took his attention off Ezio for a second, and in that second Ezio released his little pistol and fired. There was a snapping report, and a burst of flame followed by a puff of smoke seemed to shoot out from between the fingers of Ezio's right hand. The maniac, a surprised expression still on his face, fell to his knees, a neat little hole in the middle of his forehead, and some of his brains spattered on the doorpost behind him. The girl screamed and moved hastily away from him as he slowly toppled forward. Teodora shouted orders, and attendants hurried to succor the two wounded girls, but they were too late for the one in the bedroom, as she had bled to death. "You have our gratitude, Ezio," said Teodora, once order had been restored. "I was too late to save her." You saved the others. He might have slaughtered more if you hadn't been here to stop him.
What sorcery did you use to bring him down? Asked an awestruck Antonio.
No sorcery, just a secret. A grown-up cousin of the throwing knife.
Well, I can see that it's going to come in handy. Our new doge is scared stiff. He surrounds himself with guards and he never leaves the palazzo.
Antonio paused.
I imagine that Marco Barbarigo is next on your list.
He is as big an enemy as his cousin Emilio was.
We will help you, said Teodora, joining them, and our chance presents itself soon. The doge is throwing a massive party for Carnivale, and he will have to leave the palazzo for that. No expense has been spared, as he wants to buy the people's favour, even if he cannot earn it. According to my spies, he has even ordered fireworks from China.
This is why I asked you here today, Antonio explained to Ezio. Sister Teodora is one of us, and she has her finger on the very pulse of Venice.
How do I get invited to this party? Ezio asked her.
It isn't easy, she replied. You need a golden mask to get you in.
Well, it can't be so hard to lay hands on one of those.
Not so fast. Each mask is an invitation, and each is numbered.
But then Teodora smiled.
Never mind, I have an idea. I think it's possible that we might win you a mask. Come, walk with me.
She led him away from the others to a quiet little courtyard at the rear of the building, where a fountain played in an ornamental pool. They're holding some special carnival games which are open to all tomorrow. There are four events, and the winner will be awarded a golden mask and will be an honorary guest at the party. You must win it, Ezio, for access to the party gives you access to Marco Barbarigo. She looked at him. When you go, I advise you to take that little spitfire of yours with you, for you won't get close enough to knife him. May I ask you a question? You can try. I cannot guarantee an answer. I'm curious. You wear the habit of a nun, and yet, clearly, you are no such thing. How do you know that? I assure you, my son, that I am married to the Lord. But I don't understand. You are also a courtesan. Indeed, you run a bordello. Teodora smiled. I see no contradiction. How I choose to practice my faith, what I choose to do with my body, these are my choices, and I am free to make them. She paused in thought for a moment. Look, she continued, like so many young women, I was drawn to the church, but gradually I became disillusioned with the so-called believers in this city. Men only hold God as an idea in their heads, and not in the depths of their hearts and their bodies. Do you see what I'm getting at, Ezio? Men must know how to love in order to attain salvation. My girls and I provide that knowledge to our congregation. Of course, no imaginable sect of the church would agree with me, so I was obliged to create my own. It may not be traditional, but it works, and men's hearts grow firmer in my care. Among other things, I imagine. You are cynical, Ezio. She extended her hand to him. Come back tomorrow, and we will see about these games. Take care of yourself in the meantime, and don't forget your mask. I know you can take care of yourself, but our enemies are still out to get you. There were some small adjustments Ezio wanted on his new gun, so he returned to Leonardo's workshop on his way back to the Thieves' Guild headquarters. I'm glad to see you again, Ezio. You were right about Sister Teodora, Leonardo. Truly a free thinker. She would get into trouble with the church if she weren't so well protected, but she has some powerful admirers. I can imagine. But Ezio noticed that Leonardo was slightly abstracted, and looking at him strangely. What is it, Leo? Perhaps it would be better not to tell you. But if you found out by accident, it would be worse. Look, Ezio. Christina Calfucci is in Venice with her husband for Carnevale. Of course, she's Christina d'Arcenta now. Where is she staying? She and Manfredo are the guests of my patron. That is how I know. I must see her. Ezio, are you sure that's such a good idea? I'll collect the gun in the morning. I'll need it by then, I'm afraid. I have some urgent business to attend to. Ezio, I wouldn't go out unarmed. I still have my codex blades. Heart pumping, Ezio made his way to the Palazzo Pexaro via the office of a public scribe, whom he paid to write a short note which read, Christina, my darling, I must meet you alone and away from our hosts this evening at the 19th hour. I will await you at the sign of the sundial in the Rio Terra degli Ognissanti. And he had it signed, Manfredo. Then he delivered it to the Conte's palazzo and waited. It had been a long shot, but it worked. She soon emerged, with only a maidservant to chaperone her, and hurried in the direction of Dorsoduro. He followed her. When she arrived at the appointed spot, and her chaperone had retired to a discreet distance, he stepped forward. Both of them were wearing their carnival masks, but he could tell that she was as beautiful as ever. He could not help himself. He took her in his arms and kissed her long and tenderly. Finally, she broke free, and, taking off her mask, she looked at him uncomprehendingly. Then, before he could stop her, she had reached up and removed his own mask. Ezio! Forgive me, Christina, I... He noticed she no longer wore his pendant. Of course not. What the hell are you doing here? How dare you kiss me like that? Christina, it's all right. All right? I haven't seen or heard from you in 8 years.
I was just afraid he wouldn't come at all if I didn't use a little subterfuge.
You're quite right. Of course I wouldn't have come. I seem to remember that the last time we met, you kissed me in the street, and then, as cool as a cucumber, saved my fiancé's life and left me to marry him.
It was the right thing to do. He loved you, and I...
Who cares what he wanted? I loved you!
Ezio didn't know what to say. He felt as if the world had fallen away from him.
"Don't seek me out again, Ezio,"
continued Christina, tears in her eyes.
"I can't bear it. And you clearly have another life now."
"Christina,
there was a time when you would only have had to crook your finger and I..."
She interrupted herself. "Goodbye, Ezio." He watched helplessly as she walked away, rejoined her companion, and disappeared round a corner of the street. She had not looked back. Cursing himself and his fate, Ezio made his way back to the thieves' headquarters. The following day found him in a mood of grim determination. He collected his gun from Leonardo, thanked him, and retrieved the codex page, hoping that in time he would be able to get it and the other, taken from Emilio, back to his uncle Mario. Then he made his way back to Teodoro's house. From there she conducted him to the Campo di San Polo, where the games were to take place. In the centre of the square a rostrum had been erected, and on it two or three officials sat at a desk, taking the competitors' names. Among the people around, Ezio noticed the unhealthy, gaunt figure of Silvio Barbarigo. With him he was surprised to see the enormous bodyguard, Dante.
"You'll be up against him," Teodoro was saying. "Think you can take him on?"
"If I have to." Finally, when all the competitors' names had been taken, Ezio gave a false one, a tall man in a bright red cloak took his place on the rostrum. He was the master of ceremonies. There were four games in all. The contestants would vie with one another in each, and at the end an overall winner would be decided on by a panel of judges. Luckily for Ezio, many of the competitors, in the spirit of carnival, elected to keep their masks on. The first game was a foot race, which Ezio won easily, to the intense chagrin of Silvio and Dante. The second, more complicated, involved a tactical battle of wills, in which the contestants had to vie with each other as they tried to capture from one another emblematic flags which each had been provided with. In this game, too, Ezio was pronounced the winner. But he felt uneasy as he saw the expressions on the faces of Dante and Silvio.
"The third contest," announced the master of ceremonies, "combines elements of the first two and adds new ones of its own. This time you will have to use speed and skill, but also charisma and charm."
He spread his arms wide to indicate a number of fashionably dressed women about the square, who giggled prettily as he did so. "A number of our ladies have volunteered to help us with this one," continued the master of ceremonies. "Some are here in the square. Others are walking in the streets around. You may even find some in gondolas. Now, you will recognize these ladies by the ribbons they wear in their hair. Your job, honored competitors, is to collect as many ribbons as you can by the time my hourglass runs out. We'll ring the church bell when your time is up, but I think I can safely say that however fortune favors you, this will be the most enjoyable event of the day. The man who returns with the most ribbons will be the winner, and one step closer to gaining the golden mask. But remember, if there is no outright victor in these games, the judges will decide which lucky one of you will attend the Doge's party. And now, begin." The time passed, as the master of ceremonies had promised, quickly and enjoyably. The bell of San Polo rang out at a sign from him, as the last sands trickled from the upper to the lower chamber of the glass, and the competitors took up their positions back in the square, handing their ribbons over to the adjudicators, some smiling, others blushing. Only Dante remained stony-faced, and though his face grew red with anger when the count had been made, and it was, once again, Ezio's arm that the master of ceremonies held high.
"Well, my mysterious young man, you are in luck today," the master of ceremonies said. "Let's hope your good fortune doesn't desert you at the last hurdle."
He turned to address the crowd in general, while the rostrum was cleared and ropes set up round it to convert it into a boxing ring. The last contest, ladies and gentlemen, is a complete contrast. It concerns itself only with brute strength. The competitors will fight each other until all but the last two are eliminated. The last two will fight until one of them is knocked out. And then comes the moment you've all been waiting for. The overall winner of the Golden Mask will be announced. But be careful how you place your bets. There's plenty of time for upsets and surprises yet. It was in this last game that Dante excelled, but Ezio, using different skills and light on his feet, managed to make the final pair, confronting the giant bodyguard. The man swung at Ezio with fists like pile drivers, but Ezio was agile enough to ensure that no seriously heavy punches landed, and he was able to get some meaningful left uppercuts and right hooks in himself. There were no breaks between rounds in this last bout, and after a time Ezio could see that Dante was tiring. But he also, out of the corner of his eye, noticed that Silvio Barbarigo was speaking urgently to the Master of Ceremonies and the panel of judges who had gathered at a table under a canopy not far from the ring. He thought he saw a fat leather purse change hands, which the Master of Ceremonies quickly pocketed, but he couldn't be sure, as he had to return his attention to his opponent, who, angry now, was coming at him with flailing arms. Ezio ducked and landed two quick jabs to Dante's chin and body, and at last the big man went over. Ezio stood over him, and Dante glowered up.
"This isn't over yet," he growled,
but he was finding it hard to get up. Ezio looked over at the Master of Ceremonies, lifting his arm in appeal, but the man's face was stony.
"Are we sure all the competitors have been eliminated?" the Master of Ceremonies called. "All of them? We cannot announce a winner until we are sure."
There was a murmur in the crowd as two grim-looking men detached themselves from it and clambered into the ring. Ezio looked towards the judges, but they had averted their gaze. The men were closing in on him, and Ezio now saw that each had a stubby little knife, almost invisible, clutched in his paw.
"So that's how it's going to be, eh?" he said to them.
"No holds barred, then."
He danced out of the way as the fallen Dante tried to pull him off balance by grabbing his ankles, then leapt in the air to kick one of his new opponents in the face. The man spat out teeth and reeled away. Ezio came down and stamped hard on the second man's left foot, crushing the instep. Then he punched him viciously in the stomach, and as he doubled up, brought his knee into hard contact with the man's descending chin. Howling with pain, the man went over. He had bitten through his tongue, and blood gushed through his lips. Without looking back, Ezio vaulted out of the ring and confronted the Master of Ceremonies and the sheepish-looking judges. The crowd behind him cheered.
"I think we have a winner,"
Ezio told the Master of Ceremonies. The man exchanged glances with the judges and with Silvio Barbarigo, who was standing close by. The Master of Ceremonies climbed into the ring, avoiding the blood as best he could, and addressed the crowd.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he announced, after clearing his throat a little nervously, "I think you'll all agree that we've enjoyed a hard and fairly fought battle today."
The crowd cheered.
"And on such an occasion, it's hard to choose a real winner."
The crowd looked puzzled. Ezio exchanged glances with Teodora, who was standing on its fringe.
"It's been a hard job for the judges and myself," continued the Master of Ceremonies, sweating slightly and mopping his brow. "But a winner there has to be, and, on aggregate, mind, we have picked one."
Here he stooped, and with difficulty raised Dante to a sitting position.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the winner of the Golden Mask, Signore Dante Moro."
The crowd hissed and booed, yelling their disapproval, and the Master of Ceremonies, together with the judges, had to beat a hasty retreat as the bystanders began to pelt them with any rubbish they could lay their hands on. Ezio hurried across to Teodora, and the two of them watched as Silvio, a twisted smile on his livid face, helped Dante off the rostrum
and bundled him away down a side alley. Chapter 19. Back at Theodora's convent, Ezio struggled to contain himself as Theodora herself and Antonio watched him with concern.
"I saw Silvio bribe the Master of Ceremonies," said Theodora. "And no doubt he lined the judge's pockets too. There was nothing I could do."
Antonio laughed derisively, and Ezio cast him an irritable look.
"It's easy to see why Silvio was so determined to get their man to win the Golden Mask," Theodora went on. "They're still on the alert, and they don't want to take any chances with Doge Marco." She looked at Ezio. "They won't rest until you are dead."
"Then they'll have a lot of sleepless nights."
"We must think. The party's tomorrow."
"I'll find a way of shadowing Dante to the party," decided Ezio. "I'll get the mask off him somehow, and..."
"How?"
Antonio wanted to know.
"By killing the poor stronzo."
Ezio turned on him angrily.
"Do you have a better idea? You know what's at stake."
Antonio held up his hands deprecatingly.
"Look, Ezio, if you kill him, they'll cancel the party and Marco will retreat back into the palazzo. We'll have wasted our time again."
"No. The thing to do is steal the mask, quietly." "My girls can help," put in Deodora. "Plenty of them will be going to the party themselves as entertainers. They can distract Dante while you acquire the mask. And once you're there, have no fear. I will be there too." Ezio nodded reluctantly. He didn't like being told what to do, but in this instance, he knew that Antonio and Theodora were right.
"Va bene," he said.
The following day, as the sun was setting, Ezio made sure he was in place near where Dante would pass by on the way to the party. Several of Theodora's girls loitered nearby. At last, the big man appeared. He'd gone to some lengths with his clothes, which were expensive but flashy. The golden mask hung at his belt. As soon as they saw him, the girls cooed and waved, moving up to either side of him, two of them linking arms with him, making sure the mask swung behind him, and walking him to the large, cordoned-off area by the molo where the party was taking place, and had, indeed, already begun. Timing his action precisely, Ezio chose the last possible minute to cut the mask free of Dante's belt. He snatched it away and ducked ahead of Dante, to appear with it before the guardsmen who were controlling entrance to the party. Seeing it, they let Ezio in, but when, a few moments later, Dante appeared and reached behind him to put the mask on, he found that it had gone. The girls who'd escorted him had melted into the crowd and put on their own masks, so he would not recognize them.